You're listening to The Weekly Show on Discourse.
So let's call it the beginning. We've got another great show for you this week. And when I say we, I mean I, Morgan Avery, have a great show for you this week because Dylan's off sick. Some might say that the goodness of this episode is inversely proportional to the volume of that Dylan's input. But I, Morgan Avery, couldn't possibly comment. So we've got two interviews. By which I mean I, Morgan Avery, have done two interviews for you, the listener, to enjoy with no input from Dylan. First up is Luke Christensen from Generation Zero, who joins us as spokesperson for the Congestion Free Network, which Labour have just announced they'll invest in, and the Greens announced that they were adopting that as part of their transport policy a couple of weeks ago. And later on in the show, I speak with Paul Young about Climate Voter, which reached a pretty amazing milestone this week. It's a plan to get more voters of various different political persuasions, but all who are connected by the fact that they believe that climate is a significant issue. It's a way to get them all together and to make it clear to all of the parties that climate should be an issue for all of them, not just for the Green Party. Anyway, let's get cracking.
You're listening to the Weekly Show on Discourse.
So Labour announced over the weekend their transport policy. Yep. And I'm not usually excited by transport policy announcements.
Yep.
Because usually they are very disappointing. But there was one striking element in their policy, and that is that they are investing in the congestion-free network. What do you take investing to mean? did you speak with them in advance? Is this something that you've negotiated with them or discussed with them? Or do you think this is just saying they've been following the congestion-free network plan on the site, or how did they decide that this was the way to go?
Well, yeah, several of our representatives did meet with them, as well as people from Transport Blog, who are also responsible for the congestion-free network. We met with them late last year, I believe, and I also met with another. Some more people from Labor earlier this year, yeah. and we sort of went over the proposal in detail and explained it to them as well. And I know, yeah, people from the Transport Blog have been in contact with Phil Twyford as well as people from a variety of political parties,
yeah.
encouraging them to sign on to the congestion-free network.
Yeah.
So we think that that's how it has come about.
So it feels to me kind of in contrast with National, who, I mean, I don't know if they've actually said anything about the congestion-free network proposal, but they have suggested that if we get a third harbour crossing in Auckland, that there won't be any rail on it. And so it feels like they can't be all similarly adopting the ideas of the congestion-free network.
No, I understand. We have tried to get a meeting with National Party people, as have Campaign for Better Transport. They've tried several times the past year or two to meet with, I think, with Minister Brownlee, but we haven't had any luck. I think we've met with the Associate Minister Woodhouse, but we didn't really have any luck. I was sort of told he was very sceptical.
Yeah.
So, and the similar, and in terms of their press release statements in regards to when the Greens adopted the congestion-free network a few weeks ago, and similar to Labour's, they were... Yeah, their line seemed to be more around scaremongering that the money was going to be taken from elsewhere in New Zealand or saying it would cost too much, just various points that I think the background information makes clear are not true.
Yeah. So I don't know that Gerry Brownlee has a reputation for being a good listener. Maybe we need a new transport minister before we can get any real progress made. So just in broad strokes, what is the congestion-free network?
Yes, so the congestion-free network was formed late last year in response to Auckland Transport's Integrated Transport Program, which set out their 30-year vision for investing in transport in Auckland, and we were really appalled by what that came up with. It proposed spending huge amounts of money, $34 billion in new infrastructure over the next 30 years, but the report showed that congestion got worse, climate change emissions rose, and it didn't seem to be much point from this huge amount of investment.
Yeah.
So we thought there's got to be a better way, really.
Yeah.
So we looked in depth at the project list and looked at, say, what were the most important projects to really transform Auckland. We sort of thought that the motorway network in Auckland is really nearing completion with a Waterview connection. We've got a there's quite a full network across the city. But actually, what we're missing is really high quality public transport.
Yeah.
So we sort of looked at the high quality public transport projects, and we decided that we could prioritize those out to 2030. And so that's what the condition free network does. It sort of shows that we can get a really, really high quality public transport system serving all of Auckland and well within the existing transport budget.
Yeah. So I only have a handful of desires for Auckland transport stuff. One is rail to the airport, because it is absolutely baffling that we haven't got rail to the airport. It's so close to the airport. Why not just finish that spur? Or I know that from looking at the congestion-free network, some of the proposals that later on down the congestion-free network plan, there's actually not just a spur, but there's actually a connection from Mangere to the airport, and then also east out to the southern line.
Yeah, that's right. In the 2025 map, we've got rail to the airport through just extending the current Onehunga line, also to serve Mangere and the businesses out there as well as to the airport.
Yeah. So 2025 does seem like that seems quite soon. So is this like a moving window thing? So if the proposal was last year when you came out with the ideas, does that mean it should be we should just like move it along a year every year it's delayed? Or
yeah, the dates weren't designed to be exact. It was sort of in general. There's
a target, sort of a
2020, a 2025, and a 2030. So there is a there or thereabouts announcement. We just sort of had a sort of three sort of step dates every 5 years to just generally highlight what the big project was around each time frame. But
now, one question I have about now, this is not a line I'd probably use very often, and that's probably that might be the problem. So there is a rail line from Auckland up to Whangarei.
Yep.
Why aren't there any passenger services? Because it's only freight, right? Like there is no way to take a train, even though there's a line.
Yeah, I think there hasn't been passenger services for a long, long time, since the 60s or 70s. I think the line is sort of really, really slow, actually. It goes, has to go all the way out to Helensville before it comes back in. So, yeah, the problem is it would take quite a long time to get out to Whangarei, unfortunately, probably, 4 or 5 hours or something.
That does seem a little bit too long when the bus is so probably about three.
It's probably a really pretty journey, but once at once maybe in a...
Yeah. Well, I mean, but tourism is quite important to New Zealand, and tourists do internationally seem to quite like trains. And so I don't know why we don't serve them. And then, people who are really keen on taking the slow route north, then, they could also do it. It feels like most of the infrastructure is there already. Why not just, we could even do the, that silly thing we've got down the main trunk to Wellington, where there's like, just a handful of services a week. I don't see why we just don't have something. Why not take full advantage of the line we've got into this beautiful country up north? Why don't we do it? It's crazy.
Yeah, there's quite a few other examples. I've been out to Gisborne once. I'm on the rail line. That's another just an amazingly spectacular one that's sort of totally wasted. Yeah, it is a bit strange. Yeah, really.
Far from adding a service like that up north, instead, I believe that we've actually even closed one of the out west lines, like Swanson or somewhere, is like no longer even serviced. It doesn't go further than Rānui now.
It still does go out to Swanson, I understand. I think it was just Waitakere, which is just a tiny little village, they thought was a bit too expensive to get the electrics out there.
Right,
so I think
so a little bit further than I thought, but they did drop a station off the end, right?
You could get to Helensville a few years ago, but it wasn't that successful. I think it was when they were doing a lot of works on the trains, and it was all a bit slow, I think, and not at the right time. So it was a bit of a failure. But back then, maybe sometime again in the future.
A couple of years ago, because I'm quite close to work, I think everyone should live as close to work as they can. Life is much better.
Yeah, that would help too. Yeah.
I just walk, so I don't use really any transport aside from my feet. My very selfish desire is that the Stanley Street Beach Road and the Strand intersection there be... I don't even know what can happen to it. It's just so disgusting. My life is really good. And I'm the first to put my hand up for that. And that getting through that intersection twice a day is probably it's going to sound like hyperbole, but I think that's the worst thing in my whole life, going through that intersection. And so, I mean, the poor bastards who have to wait, and, you know, I don't ever have to wait longer than one cycle when I'm walking, but there's these poor bastards stacked up in their cars up Parnell Rise and along Stanley Street trying to, you know, waiting to turn and so on for so much longer. Absolutely miserable. I have seen some proposals to fix it, like dividing off traffic which is going to go onto the motorway and go a long distance away from, like, cycle traffic and local traffic. Better Transport Auckland thing, or a congestion-free proposal thing, or is that – because I don't actually remember where the proposal came from. It was on Transport Blog to fix Stanley Street.
Yeah, that's right. I actually live quite close to there as well, and I sort of I try to avoid that intersection, but it's pretty hard if you're going into town and it is a terrible mess. It sort of like takes ages to cross if you walk across and there's trucks screaming around that corner there and nearly getting
those
run over.
Those trucks. Man, those trucks are insane. Yeah. So, like, when that guy was killed, I guess it was a couple of months ago now, people were talking, you know, mainly on those terrible sites like KiwiBlog and stuff, about how terrible it is that cyclists blow through the lights all the time. It's like, you know, walk with me to work a couple of mornings and you'll see who's actually blowing through those lights. So maybe that guy did go through a red. I've never seen a bicycle go through a red light at that intersection.
Yeah,
but every single day I see very large, fully laden trucks blow through a red light there every day.
Yeah, me too. Every time you just can't sort of step out on the green. You've always got to wait a few seconds and see if someone's running the sort of the right turn just before you walk across. It's pretty sketchy.
We need to have there's little things that I feel like we should have. Like, in most countries, cars have to give right of way to pedestrians, like, everywhere. But not in New Zealand. Like, the only place you get that is on pedestrian crossings. And otherwise, it's just basically you need to be able to stop before hitting anything. But it's not about giving way to pedestrians. And, like, just so change that rule.
Yeah, I'm quite supportive of that. I sort of walk around a lot as well whenever I'm sort of not cycling. And yeah, you've really got to be careful. Even at zebras, you sort of see people screaming straight through. You've got to sort of point your finger at them and say, hey.
Yeah.
Hey, come on, man.
It's crazy. It's really crazy. And you wait a while for it too. You know, I'm not a fan of those trucks through there. And they do have, again, I think they should be using the rail more. I know that they actually do send quite a lot of freight off on rail from the port there. But just, I mean, there's so many trucks. It seems like it's quite expensive to maintain the roads for those trucks. So I know that it's expensive to put rail lines in as well, but the rail line's already there. Just use it.
Yeah, that would make a lot more sense, especially maybe like it's pretty busy during the day with commuter trains, but overnight I think it would make things a lot better with sort of, that area, the whole area around Stanley Street's pretty nasty to walk along or just forget about biking along there because, all those trucks screaming past all day, it's just not fun.
So I've seen just in the last couple of days that there is a new cycle lane has been painted down around that beach road curve. I haven't seen any bicycles on it yet because it's brand new, and so hopefully that is the start of some improvement. Because I mean, I don't really see how it could be much worse. So I mean, it has to be better. We have to do better. I feel like in New Zealand, you know, obviously. You know, this kind of fundamental infrastructure, it is pretty expensive to build it. You know, the best case scenario, it's pretty expensive. Building a tunnel over to the shore or another bridge or whatever the next crossing is, it's going to be expensive no matter what.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is why we have to always just do it right. So when we built our harbour bridge, I mean, I think that the original design was not for, you know, four little lanes. The original design was for bigger than that. And central government, I think this is right, they decided they didn't want to fund that. And so they squashed the plan and put it down into four, maybe it was five lanes in the center. And then, of course, almost immediately, we needed to come along with a much more expensive engineering bodge job and tack on the clip-ons when we should have done it right the first time for cheaper. We can't afford to do this stuff the wrong way. Because we're little, you know, we have to only get it right. And getting it right it's necessarily expensive. We just can't fuck around with it. It just gets more and more expensive.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I understand that the original proposals for the Harbour Bridge had got trains and trams and walking and cycling and just everything. Maybe they could have stuck with four traffic lanes if you could have a really fast train way back in the 50s. But as soon as you just had just cars, it just filled up really, really quickly, unsurprisingly.
Yeah.
And it looks like we're finally getting the cycleway on there in the next year or two. But to add rail would cost another few billion, and then talking about adding another tunnel, that's just crazy. It's just five billion, and then you would still just get stuck in traffic at the Takapuna end or the city end. So you know, you'd have to build another huge tunnel for billions and billions.
It's someone mentioned the other day that only in Auckland would we have a bridge crossing where it was free to drive a car, but you had to pay a toll to ride a bicycle.
Yeah, that is a bizarre situation. It's just a real shame. I'm not sure why NZTA haven't and the government haven't gotten behind and just built the sky path. But the solution they've come up with, it's sort of making the best of a bad situation, I think. So.
Does the congestion-free network, does that propose another harbour crossing?
We've sort of proposed a rail-only crossing in about 2030.
Yeah.
2030 or so, I think that would be the real way to sort of free up the Northern Motorway, because you could, I don't know, get a train to Albany in 20 minutes from the city or something. You can move sort of really huge numbers of people around the city. So, yeah, we think that's the way to go.
Yeah. It's building a roading a car only option seems absolutely bizarre, because correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it the case that car traffic during rush hour has actually either been flat or possibly even dropping a little bit over the last few years over the Harbour Bridge?
Yeah, actually, if you look, I think traffic volumes are sort of lower now than what they were 10 years ago, and that's all down to the busway. People sort of shows that people will get out of cars when you give them a decent service.
Yeah.
And it's sort of great that you can sort of speed along past the traffic and even the dear people of the North Shore are happy to get out of their cars and into a bus, which 10 years ago no one would have probably thought was possible. But
yeah, I mean, it's the old land, build it and they will come, you know. So we've seen, probably pretty significant improvements to what we have in our commuter rail over the last decade. Has seen a huge increase in the patronage of commuter rail in Auckland. It's like hundreds of percent, right, over the last decade.
Yeah, I think it's gone up by about five or sixfold. And even I think in June, there were 20% more people used in June this year than last year. So there's like, and that's only with a little bit of talk about electric trains. We think it will really, really boost ahead in the next couple of years. So that's why we sort of think this really need to get ahead with the city rail link, because the other Britomart will soon fill up and the trains will soon be full again. But if we haven't started on the city rail link, we'll have to wait. We'll have 5 years of packed out trains again, which would be a real shame.
Yeah. Serious cities all around the world, they have decent rail. It's the characteristic that I've noticed that they all share. They have decent rail. There's no getting away from it. It's the way to move people around. And if our city's going to get hugely bigger than it is over the next several decades, and all of the projections are that we're going to get much bigger, if we're a bit unmanageable now, it's going to be absolutely bonkers. We have no choice but to do it. So I hope that either National get on board, or you know, whatever happens at the election, that I hope that the parties that have endorsed the congestion-free network, I hope that they really do it. Do you have any misgivings about Labor, or have they kept it pretty simple in their endorsement, their plans to invest?
Yeah, there wasn't as much detail in the Labor policy as was in the Greens policy. So I think they might have got scared of the headlines from the Greens one, where they were like, oh, $10 billion, it's going to $10 billion taken out of rural New Zealand or some sort of rubbish like that. So they didn't want to sort of totally commit. Yeah.
I know you can't say it, but I'm going to say it. Fuck rural New Zealand. New Zealand lives in cities now, and we need them to be excellent cities. We need them to be the best cities in the world. And on many measures, they already are considered pretty great cities in the grand scheme of things. So let's be the best. How about that?
Yeah, man, but that sounds, yeah, really, really good. And the big thing Auckland has always fallen down on is transport. Which, as you said before, we're sort of one of the only cities around that tried to sort of like build a decent sized city and just not have any rail or any decent buses or anything for such a long time. So we really need to turn that around.
I remember in my lifetime seeing rail lines. I guess they were tram lines along Quay Street.
Yeah.
And gone. Oh, yeah. My God. Madness. I tell you what, it's baffling.
Yeah, it is. It was, it's hard to explain some of the things that happened in the past of Auckland, even the quite recent past in the, in the 90s or something.
We've spoken about transport stuff quite a lot previously on Discourse, and I seem to recall that the Auckland tram network was something like 70 kilometres of lines. And now it's just gone. We've got this silly little loop where no one wants it for tourists with the wrong stock on it. And it's like, how did we get rid of such a potentially useful thing so recently? I mean, it's just, how could anyone have made worse choices for Auckland unless they were actually intending to screw us up? So hopefully now we can get things back on track. We've got a new generation. We've got Generation Zero, and we're going to fix this thing.
Yep, that's what we're working pretty hard to do. Yeah, there are a lot of those decisions, you read about them, and they were just totally sort of captured by motorway mania in the 50s. And most places, even America, they sort of realized by the 60s that it was a bad idea, but we kept on going and sort of until the 90s, really. It's crazy.
So, I mean, cars are great, but just like Coca-Cola, it's not an everyday food. You know, just use a car when you actually have to.
Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, Luke Christensen from Generation Zero, thank you so much for joining us on Discourse. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, that's ready.
All right, so next up on the show, we're talking about climate. Some say that there is, we ride on the back of a giant turtle swimming its enigmatic way through the vast emptiness of some interstellar void. And I'm not even sure then that climate exists. So we should probably talk to someone who has a differing view. Paul Young from Climate Voter. Does climate exist?
I think it's safe to say that a climate exists. Yeah.
I've just been reading, a little bit. I don't usually do research, so let's get that out of the way up front. I don't usually do research. I've done a little bit, so I made the mistake of reading the comments, like on the Herald and stuff. And there are people out there who are, listen, they are fucking crazy. They literally, they want to destroy the planet. If not through inaction, then intentionally, or at least they give off every sign of that. It's absolutely bizarre, and it must be very hard for you keeping, for one thing, a straight face, or two, not having it break your heart.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I try to minimize the amount of time I spend reading comment sections on certain websites to keep my sanity.
Just can't read the comments. There's too many. Like, oh my God. And these people, they vote. Oh, Christ.
Yeah.
So we have to do something about that, because there's a lot of these crazy people. We need to find some way of organizing people who aren't crazy, people who maybe believe that climate exists, also climate change. And if only there was some way to get people together and say, I might be a classical liberal. I might be a lifelong national voter. And I might be a little bit appalled that Tim Grosser, the so-called climate change minister, literally said, quote, "We're not playing God on this. That natural process will determine what happens to adaptation of human beings and other mammals and species. The national position is that we're going to evolve our way through climate change." Ignoring that evolution is really slow, and it requires, literally it requires that generations die off and only a few hardy individuals survive in the new environment. That is the national solution. So, if you're a classical liberal, maybe you need to think about putting your vote somewhere else. You know, hold your nose and vote for someone who's actually taking this seriously and is prepared to sit at the big boys' table and doesn't have their hands over their eyes. Now, I know, Paul, that the climate voter campaign. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. We should probably talk about what it is. But I know that it is not actually a campaign for a specific party. It is actually just for getting everyone to consider climate as part of, you know, when they make their decision to vote, and for the political parties to realize that there are serious voters of all stripes who care about the environment. So what actually is Climate Voter?
Yeah, hey, you've kind of nailed it, really. Yeah, there's three things that it's about. It's about having a platform for people to sign on and say, hey, this is a voting issue for me. You know, it's something that I do consider when I vote, because often climate change isn't seen that way. It's about trying to raise the importance of this as a voting issue and say, you know, it's an important thing to be weighing up parties' policies on. And then it's about, yeah, shining a bit of a spotlight on what different parties are going to promise to do about this. And that's why we've been asking questions of the week through Twitter to all political parties. And we've got this debate coming up on the 3rd of September where we've got all the major parties fronting up for a debate specifically focused on climate change, with Samantha Hayes hosting it.
That's brilliant. So the Twitter account is ClimateVoterNZ. So now, I first became aware of Climate Voter, the campaign. I guess you've actually only been around a couple of months, but right?
That's right. Yeah, I should say I'm part of Generation Zero, and so we've been around about 3 years. The Climate Voter campaign launched in June, and it's a collaboration between us, Greenpeace, Forest and Bird, Oxfam, 350 Aotearoa, and WWF New Zealand.
I hoped that you wouldn't mention Generation Zero, because I didn't want the listeners to figure out that I fucked up this week and invited two Generation Zero guys along when I thought that I was covering entirely separate issues. But Generation Zero just actually cares about big issues. And so there you go. If you want to deal with a big issue, then you're going to run across a couple of Generation Zero guys.
Yeah. Oh, sorry to
When I first started pursuing the Climate Voter thing, I was talking to Greenpeace, and then suddenly I wasn't talking to Greenpeace anymore. Can you just assure me that this, not that I actually even care, but this is definitely not a Green Party AstroTurf thing, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's absolutely not. And you know, all the organizations involved believe really passionately that, you know, climate change can't be continue to be seen that way if we're actually going to make progress on it. It's not good enough for just, you know, people to see it as just one party's issue, and all parties need to have serious policies on it, just like, you know, health, education, anything else that's just fundamental to our future.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, the World Bank, the IMF, the OECD, all these pretty conservative state, you know, organizations are really issuing some pretty bold and dramatic calls for action. So are they rabid, you know, greenies and left wingers? I don't think so. You know, we need to change the debate here to put aside the left and right way that it's viewed and say, actually, every party, you know, needs to have policies on this, and the debate should be about different ways of solving the problem through, you know, more of a left or right approach, rather than whether we're actually going to do anything to reduce our emissions.
I think it's not left or right. It's about near term and long term. You know, near term, if you only think in the shortest window of time, then it's all right to be really selfish. But if you actually think in a longer term, in civilization terms, and, you know, not even just parents, but, you know, thinking about your children's children, if you think in the longer term, I think some of the choices that you make will be more carefully considered and less damaging, because, you know, we live on really small islands. We can see the damage that's already been done only in the last couple of decades. I mean, just look at, you know, I know it's only a very small part of the issue, but look at our waterways. Like, I'm not 40 years old, but when I was a child, there were very few places that weren't safe to swim, like immediately downstream from a freezing works or somewhere, right? Because we did have problems with discharging stuff into rivers. There were places you couldn't swim, but there were very few places you couldn't swim. It was pretty unlikely that, you know, you would go to just some random, pick a lake, and you'd be told, actually, you probably shouldn't swim here because we've got terrible pollution in our waterways. And now, like, in not even a whole generation, it feels like, our waterways have gone completely to shit. We would, if we were thinking longer term, instead of, you know, letting an individual farmer decide that to maximize the profit per hectare of his land, he was going to increase his number of livestock and he was going to have them closer to waterways. If you were thinking longer term, you just couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't force people to think long term. We let them do this kind of maximum growth, maximum profit in the next fiscal quarter, you know, but we do really need to be thinking decades and centuries down the track, because some of this stuff has a huge effect that starts slow and builds up, you know. So you will be very familiar with this thing where if you talk about what used to be called global warming, and probably still should be called global warming, but it seems to be confusing for some people. Mm-hmm. They will say, oh, but the surface temperatures haven't increased in the last decade. But, you know, the more research that's done, it turns out that that is actually being absorbed at the bottom of the oceans. But what happens, and they're being used essentially like a battery, and the temperatures, the amount of energy there is increasing. So what happens when we exceed that capacity? Suddenly, we're going to have some sort of, I mean, these things, they can, it could be like a chain of dominoes where it tries to take up the slack, all of the rope that we try and take from the planet. And then at some point, we're going to run out of slack. One of your projections, I think it was it in Climate Photo? Or was it the New Zealand Climate Change Council or whatever they're called? They're talking about the number of days that we're going to have extreme fire risk. And in like 30 years, it's going to be 400% increased or something from where it is now.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the distant future. You know, virtually all of us are going to be still alive then. And it's going to be like 700% increased in 90 years, you know, when probably none of us will be around. But it's going to be increasing constantly every year. It's just going to be getting worse and worse. This is not some academic consideration that's happening in the distant future. We're starting to experience this now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
I will let you talk now.
No, it's all interesting stuff, and I hadn't actually seen that recent statistic that you mentioned about the fire risk. But yeah, that
might not be quite the right numbers, but I know it was something. It was something like that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's one of those things that I think like when you're, especially if you're younger and you haven't been around for as long, like you sort of accept as normal a lot of things that aren't really normal, you know, because we've kind of like you're saying with the waterways. I mean, people who are just, you know, hitting their teens now will just, they never experience what it was like, you know, two decades ago to know how much things have changed. And things are changing really rapidly in terms of climate change impacts, really, in the scheme of things, on when you think about it, you know, length of a human life. I mean, one thing that really frightens me a bit is on a sort of current policies, business as usual pathway, we're on track for about 4 degrees of warming so that's, you know, starting from where we were at before the industrial era started, 4 degrees of global warming by 2100. And 4 degrees doesn't sound like a lot to some people, but there's a really good, I don't know if people know XKCD comics. There's a really good comic they did where it puts it in ice age units. Mm. So it was about 4.5 degrees colder in the last ice age than it was before we started burning all this, all these fossil fuels.
Mm.
And we're looking at being about that much warmer in 2100. And that's just, you know, you're talking about a completely different planet that you're gonna result in. And we just have no idea whether that's what that's going to do to our lives, really.
Mm.
The World Bank issued a report saying there is no certainty that we can adapt to a 4-degree world on this, especially on this time frame.
Mm.
There's talk, I think you raised some earlier, about this talk about sort of, you know, we'll just have to do some adapting. And really, you know, we have to call bullshit on that, because we just don't know what the hell this is going to be like and how and if we can adapt.
Yeah. I don't think we can adapt. And if Tim Grosser says that the adaptation is not merely cultural but evolutionary, which is it's literally what he said, then we're basically – they are planning for us to be fucked. Their plan is for us to just die.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'd come to slightly to the fence of Tim Grosser here. I mean, I think he's got a way with words, and often some of the stuff he says comes across pretty interestingly. But I think he's certainly on record as saying, you know, he's definitely a believer in the science, yeah, to his credit.
Right.
He doesn't dispute that. Whereas some, you know, I think there are some members of National Party who are still, you know, questionable on that.
Yeah.
But yeah, their point of view is, there's nothing much, you know, anything we do here in terms of our emissions is going to make bugger all difference. So we're just going to do some research on how to reduce agricultural emissions over the longer term, and we're going to try and, you know, influence a global treaty. But it's you know, we would disagree with that. At Generation Zero, this is just that, you know, how the hell can we be trying to influence the global negotiations positively if we're visibly doing bugger all here, you know, and not walking the talk. And yeah, New Zealand can be one of those countries that's actually showing how it's done and
take a leadership position.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's not about sacrificing ourselves. This is the other thing. This is the way that the National Party talks about it. Like, we'll be sacrificing ourselves if we do this. But, you know, there's so many opportunities for us to actually improve our lives and even improve our economy, we think, yeah, by taking action. Yeah, it's like, you know, coming back to what you said about short-term, long-term. It's like, yeah, if you look at things on a political three-year window, there might be a bit of financial pain for some of these things. But, like, other countries aren't looking at it that way. You look at this, countries like Denmark, where they've got cross-partisan commitment to trying to get completely free of fossil fuels by 2050, and they're going, oh, actually, this is going to pay off. You know, it's like paying insurance, you know?
That feels like a change that New Zealand should be almost uniquely well-placed to beat them to, because, I mean a decade or more ago, weren't we already on, like, at some times, like 70 or 90% renewable, because we have such large hydro generation. So we only need, you know, our usage has probably increased since then. But also the potential sources of generation's increased as well, because there's all this like wave energy stuff, you know, ocean currents and so on, and also hugely improved wind generation and improved even solar. I'm not sure that solar is good for like network stuff rather than individual stuff. But like, I feel like New Zealand should be really well placed to make that sort of move sooner than almost anyone. Because we have these big hydro generation dams, and we've got geothermal stuff already, I feel like we're pretty far ahead of the curve there. Why not just finish it off?
Yeah, did right. I mean, New Zealand's got a really, you know, proud history of actually showing a lot of leadership and innovation in renewable energy. It's really important to think beyond just electricity. Like, when you break down how fossil fuels are used in New Zealand, oil is the big thing, and transport. It's about three times as much emissions from that as from our electricity generation, because we're pretty good on that front. And then there's about double our electricity generation emissions comes from other places we're using fossil fuels, like particularly making milk powder. You know, we're burning gas and coal to evaporate milk and dry timber and these sort of things.
Right.
So when you look at the big picture, yeah, we're still well ahead of the curve compared to most countries, and we've still got massive potential on all of those areas, but we've got a bit further to go. Yeah, electricity will be the easy thing. We've got no problems there, and we can be the first country to have a diverse 100% renewable electricity grid and show how it's done. And transport is an area we've focused on a lot with Generation Zero, because it's the biggest source of CO2 emissions. It's there's so much more we could be doing to reduce car dependence and more public transport, walking and cycling, and also trying to accelerate the shift to electric transport, which is really good because New Zealand's got so much renewable electricity. So, you know, it's all you look at the whole picture, New Zealand's got opportunities everywhere, and we should be doing, it's a no-brainer really.
Paul, I'm about to blow your mind. Because you know what? I'm going to tell you in two words. I'm going to tell you the best form of transport in the world, and coincidentally, it's electric. Unfortunately, we're never going to get it. Two words, bullet trains.
Oh.
They are electric. Now, unfortunately, we're too small and impoverished, I think, to ever have bullet train lines, let's say, between Auckland and whatever city replaces Wellington when it falls into the sea after the big one. But, man, bullet trains are the best, and they're electric. Oh, it's the best way to travel. If have you been on a bullet train? I hope you have.
No, I...
Everyone needs to ride the bullet trains, man. Yeah. That is just... It is... I mean, every seat feels like business class or better on a plane, right? It's comfortable and it's fast, it's smooth, and there's no messing around with lines. You walk up to a platform, you get into a train, and you get whisked off on this magic carpet that just accelerates forever up to these amazing speeds. It is the best. But we're not going to get it here, but it is the best, and electric. Electric can be extraordinarily powerful.
Yeah. So, the economics might be questionable in New Zealand.
Definitely. Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah.
But who knows, longer term. And, just in general, electrifying transport just makes so much sense. We can do it. We are making steps to electrify Auckland's train network, which is cool. That's going to make it way nicer service. Cleaner. It means it's not contributing to your urban pollution either. And electric vehicles, they're not the perfect solution. I mean, I think where it's possible to, shift away from being dependent on the car, it's better. But electric, they're going to be a big part of the solution here. And I mean, it's another thing that once people try and electric cars, and they are getting cheaper. I think people are actually going to prefer them to the current thing.
I want to talk about that some more, but I've just looked up what I mentioned about the days with extreme fire risk. So it was the New Zealand Climate Change Centre, and it was a report that they produced, a summary of the expected impacts of climate change in New Zealand, that they based on the IPCC's fifth assessment report, and I pretty much was right. By 2040, they predict a 400% increase in days with extreme fire risk, and that's not very long from now. And by 2090, a 700% increase in days with extreme fire risk. That's pretty serious.
It is. Yeah.
Because, I mean, that doesn't just mean, sporadic bushfires, although that is what it would mean. But it means that the weather has to be so dry and hot that it is fostering that kind of environment where that happens. You don't get extreme fire risk and then a lovely cooling rain in the evening. With the extreme fire risk days, that is drought conditions, right? A 400% increase in not even 30 years.
That is
crazy. That is so absolutely crazy.
And think about Australia, New Zealand, at least, that'll be bad, but Australia already gets hammered every summer, right? By big bushfires. And imagine it's just going to be an inferno there, if nothing is done. That's going to impact us massively as well. So we've got to look beyond our shores too, I think, and think about the way we're interconnected with other countries and dependent on them for our own well-being.
So I do want to talk a little bit about cars, even though it's probably not a big part of the climate voter campaign. Cars are really cool. Cars are amazing. It is so great that you can get into basically an extension of your living room, a great big plush chairs like a lazy boy, turn up the stereo. You don't have to have any engagement with the outside world. You can pretend they're not even there. You can just drift around, blasé as fuck, just pretend they don't exist. And then you get to where you're going. A garage door closes behind you. You get out of your airlock, and it's as if you didn't even pass through the world. You can pretend that communities are a thing of the past. You can pretend that you're all alone in the world. Cars are listen. This is not a granola friendly thing. This is not a vegan. I don't even know what the modern slurs are for hippies. Like the sound of a V8, that burble, that and that roar of like those really shitty, badly engineered American V8s. They absolutely suck, but they sound so good. So it would be a real shame to waste all of the oil on, you know, other stuff. We should save some of the oil, or we should find some new source of something like petrol so that we can keep having wonderful V8s, but only when we really need to.
Yeah.
That's not a car to drop the kids off at school and then drive to work in. it's really not.
You know, I don't disagree. I think it's you're right. I mean, one other opportunity New Zealand's got, just in, you know, if we're talking about solutions that don't require going back to live in a cave and, you know, cry ourselves to sleep every night.
Yeah.
Bioenergy in New Zealand, you know, biofuels get a bad rap, and fair enough. I think the biofuels that have been brought to market so far, particularly in the US, have been pretty stupid, making ethanol from corn and stuff. You know, it actually causes more emissions over the whole life cycle than just using fuel. So there's been some dumb stuff done, but there is some pretty cool potential in New Zealand and elsewhere to use woody biomass to make biofuels. And this that mean, you know, can be grown on land that isn't competing with food production, which is the big concern. There's a project that Z Energy actually, along with another company called Norske Skog, who like process wood and make paper, they're doing a pilot project to make biofuels from wood waste, basically, that you know, that gets generated when we're making paper and things like that. And New Zealand's got massive potential there from the research that's been done. So, you know, it's certainly possible that if the price of oil keeps rising, and especially, then there are going to be alternatives that are, you know, sustainable, basically sustainable petrol, if you like.
Yeah.
That isn't contributing to climate change. So, yeah.
Right, because it's current cycle carbon. It's not fossil carbon. So it doesn't actually matter if you emit it.
That's right. Yeah.
Or not so much. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So basically, there's no time to waste. We need to have higher technology sources of fuels so we can save the
V8. Yeah, save the V8. That's a good campaign slogan. Because if we don't get our shit sorted, then we're going to have no option but to either have a hellish climate or go back to living in caves. So we'd better start now.
I think actually, if we had the hellish climate, we would go back to living in caves, because one would follow the other.
That's,
you know,
true.
We can either fix this stuff and we can secure the future of our civilizations, or we can fail to fix it and we are just going to – I mean, our generation might only suffer a little bit, like with more storms and stuff, but it will just keep getting worse and worse and worse and worse. We have to save our civilization. And I think the solution is high technology.
Yep.
Smart technology. A lot of it exists already. We just need to do it. I don't know about I don't know what works really well. Maybe the woody biomass thing is right. Maybe the algae derived oils is the right way to go. Maybe, I mean, there's a whole lot of options. And hey, I've got an idea. Let's just do all of them and see what sticks.
Totally. Yeah, we don't know yet how it's going to evolve. But coming back to, you know, Denmark, my holy grail of countries that are doing the right thing, they're doing exactly that. You know, they're looking at all the options and they're trying to support all of them and making a bit of a strategy for that has some flexibility in it, of course, but making a strategy for how they can just phase out the fossil fuels. And, you know, it's about just setting a clear direction so that all the innovators can get to work and know that there's going to be a market there for these products. They're not going to have the rug swept out from them, like has happened here in New Zealand, where there was the previous government had a policy around biofuels, and then the national government scrapped it, and it meant that, you know, the people who had started providing them got screwed, basically. Mm. So yeah, it's just having that long term vision that isn't going to flip flop every 3 or 6 years.
Mm. I want to make, as well as saving the V8, I want to make Denmark jealous. It seems like, you know, often we use Denmark as the example of, you know, the country that we should aspire to be more like. I think that we should make them aspire to be more like us.
And you're a slogan machine. That's great. Save the V8 and make Denmark jealous.
And does climate actually exist? Paul, thank you so much for joining us. I know that I go off the rails a little bit sometimes, but there are my the normal adult who keeps me on the ground. He's not here. He's off sick. And so you got the full noise version of Morgan. I apologize for that.
That was a pleasure.
If we can convince you to come back after this, I promise next time we'll be more sane and coherent, probably, if you're lucky. Thank you so much for joining us. Oh, actually, and the last thing, the reason that I got you on is because Climate Voter, which I encountered it a while ago. I saw the thing about the court case. The Electoral Commission decided that you are like a campaign organization or something.
Not exactly, but they said that the Climate Voter website is classified as electoral advertising.
Right.
Which they're not saying we're saying vote Greens or whatever, but they're saying it's subject to some regulation, and we're saying, well, we're just testing that out at court because it's kind of untested law and it's very ambiguous right now.
Yeah. So I heard about that, the court case, and I hope that, I feel like they have to solve that rationally and sensibly. But the most recent thing that happened, like I heard about the thing and I was like, oh yeah, I bet they'll get a few thousand members and it'll be they'll have an interesting voice. But in just a couple of months, you're over 45,000 people have signed up to the Climate Voter campaign, which I think is extraordinary.
Yeah. So it's up to about 2% of the number of people who voted last election. So it's getting to that. We're really stoked that it's grown to that and still growing strong. Yeah. So we'll just keep going, and it's getting to that point where, saying significant votes here on the line, every political party's got to be looking at their policies and going, are these good enough?
Yeah. Are they good enough? We're going to find out. It's going to take a while, but we're going to find out. Thank you so much, Paul.
Cheers, Morgan. Pleasure.
When I talked on Classic Hits Waikato FM, but that was a lot more professional than this.
And there's that. That's how it goes when I'm by myself, turns out. By myself. I mean, obviously, I wasn't alone. I wasn't doing the voices of people that I invented. We are progressing our plans for the election show, Discourse Votes 2014. That's going to be a thing that happens with Dylan and Hollywood Ben Gracewood and myself and a bunch of other people. And, if you watched last time, you'll know that it was actually a pretty great show. Considering how it wasn't remotely half-assed. There were a bunch of incredible professionals who normally do real stuff, and we managed to convince them to help us with that, and we're going to do a similar thing again. It's going to be really good. Also, the Ice Bucket Challenge that I mentioned last week, I'd been called out, still haven't done it. I had 24 hours, I haven't done it. Might not do it. Also, last week, in 5.06, I replaced almost all the swears. Dylan isn't here, so we can't talk about whether that was worth it. Maybe you can tell me if you think it was worth it. Did you prefer to hear the whoops instead of the swears? I know that I missed two. I didn't realize until after the show was published, of course, that I'd missed two. There were a lot of swears to get rid of. Took a long time. Probably not worth it, but was it? You tell me. Also, I said nuts last week too many times. Far too many times. All right, that's it. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. Doesn't really mean anything in this context. Get out.
Fish and chips. Fish and chips. Fish and chips.
This show is cancelled. Beep.
I'm Morgan. Just in case you didn't get that.